You're tuned to Tidings, and this is Hazel Khan. In the middle of December last year, predictions that the world would end next week were lighting up the airwaves, animating conversations, and terrifying people around the world. Oh no, the end of the world again? Why do we humans keep doing this? Why doesn't it matter that the predictions are always wrong? I thought perhaps psychotherapists could explain some of this, and so I turned to John Hill, a notable Jungian analyst at the International School of Analytical Psychology. We spoke via Skype from Zurich, and I asked John Hill how he came to be where he is.
Well, first of all, I came originally from Ireland. I've lived in the States, I've lived in France, and since about 45 years now in Switzerland. I became a Jungian analyst when I was about 27, 28, so very young I started. And since then, you know, I started the Jung Institute, got my diploma for the Jung Institute in 1973. And, well, that's when I was nearly 30, 29. And then I gradually became a training analyst. That's this Lehr Analytica. Training analyst, a supervising analyst, a lecturer at the Jung Institute. And unfortunately, there was problems there, and the community broke up, and we formed a second institute here in Zurich, a training institute, which is called, for short, ISAP Zurich, meaning it's the International School of Analytical Psychology. And that's where I am until today.
So I'm sorry, so where was the original Jung Institute?
That's the famous Jung Institute, the original Jung Institute. It was when I studied in, it was in Zurich, in the Gemeindestraße, which was founded by Jung in the 1940s and is still existing in Küsnacht. It's a very large, beautiful building on the lakeside.
Do you do private practice as well?
Yes, I mean, that's probably most of my work. Certainly, I was extremely busy when I was at the Jung Institute, because in the 70s, 80s, even in the 90s, there were between 300 and 350 candidates, training candidates at the Jung Institute. Depth psychology, Jungian psychology was flourishing during that time. And maybe since we've had the computer or more CBT, you know, cognitive behavior therapy, and of course less insurance money, there's been less collective support for depth psychology. There are many reasons. Some say it's too long. It can't be tested sufficiently. All those one could call to question. Nevertheless, especially young people want more or less a quicker, less expensive therapy. Certainly the insurance companies want that. But, you know, if you go down deeply and look into the biography of someone, that's not something that you can do very quickly.
What proportion of what you do then is analysis as opposed to teaching?
Yes, that would definitely be the larger. It's hard to say, maybe 70%. It's a bit changed now. At one stage, maybe I did 80% private practice, 20%. I'm just saying these things roughly. But now I find myself being more asked to travel and give lectures outside of Zurich and in Zurich. So the result is that I'm giving a lot of time to writing. I've written a book. The title of my book is called At Home in the World, Sounds and Symmetries of Belonging. I've published many, many articles. And, of course, inevitably lots of lectures. I just came back from Tbilisi, Georgia, where I am the liaison for the International Association of Jungian Psychology. And I work with them and the Georgian Society to train analysts in Tbilisi.
Tell us who Jung is and tell us why Jung is important today, especially against this context of people wanting quicker, more impulsive, if you will, therapy.
Jung was a psychiatrist who worked in the Burgholzli in Zurich, which was something like the Mayo Clinic at the beginning of the 20th century. And he became more or less world fame by working with the association experiment and also coming along with sort of new ideas about schizophrenia. In other words, that the fantasies that you discover in schizophrenia have meaning. He was one of the first to really establish that. Then in 1911 and so, after the break with Freud, because he was also the crown prince of psychoanalysis and a friend of Freud, Sigmund Freud, he had this encounter with his unconscious, which now has become published in the Red Book, in which he meets all kinds of strange figures. And those kind of visionary experiences led to working out his own view of depth psychology. So Jungian psychology is somehow a continuation of Freudian psychoanalysis, but giving a completely different shift to psychoanalysis.
The Mayan calendar has grabbed unbelievable attention for the last, I don't know, year or two. Very much has captivated popular consciousness about the end of the world occurring on December 21st, which I think is next week. Can you talk about what is interesting about the Mayan calendar and about, well, what is interesting about how it has captured the zeitgeist, the consciousness, certainly of much of the Western world, certainly of this part of the world where I am in America? What is it about the Mayan calendar or the date, the end of the world?
I think I just start something very general. Ancient civilizations are mysterious. So if you've been to Egypt or, let's say, Guatemala, and I've been to both places, and you look at these sort of strange edifices of a culture which we know relatively little about, maybe more about Egypt, but less so about the Maya. And then somehow it's filled with mystery. It's like something of the past that is incredibly powerful and beautiful, but very strange, very different from our culture. So immediately there's a sort of fascination, an interest. What were these people about? And so when you come and read about their calendar, it has a certain, what you could say, mystery about it, which immediately interests people. And why would these people, whom one maybe thought were less civilized than we are, that's a big question, how could they work out a calendar that lasts for thousands of years? And also they are very remarkably for their astronomical knowledge. It's the mystery of a lost civilization that's more fascinating than maybe the contemporary civilization. So that means, because it's relatively unknown, we project a lot onto it. A lot of maybe hopes or fears or fantasies. They know about everything. They're like the gods. And of course, these are projections because they're not based on real solid knowledge. So, for example, this idea of the end of the world, as far as I know, I'm not a great specialist in Mayan culture, it seems to be that this is not the end of the world, that is the end of a cycle, because it seems that the notion of the cyclic understanding of existence, meaning the process of everything is born, lives, and dies, is inherent in that civilization. So that the Mayans seem to be saying is that there are cycles, not only in individual life, but also in history, in the collective, where a culture dies and is reborn in another way. So just looking at from what I know about the Mayans is that there's a certain limit, there's a certain change, a kind of cultural change where something is gone, passes away, so that the new can take its place. It just shows you what an amazing imagination these people had, the imagination of time over thousands of years. That is an extraordinary accomplishment.
But yet the appeal and the attraction of all of this, negative as well as positive attraction, is because it is about time, because it is a calendar, and that connects the old ancient culture to us today. I mean, there's a date, 2012, that's us today, right? So people take it all personally. It's not an academic interest in what the Mayans have been saying.
Yes, well, I would say if somebody really believes that the world is going to end 21st of December this year, That is a concretization of something that we really do not understand, what really these Mayans meant about. I would say that in the Mayan system, all this is more not literal, but symbolic. Just symbolic that this is an edifice of time, of an imaginative time in which a civilization is going to end. Although one can say that certainly in the last, 100 years, there has been an enormous change. I would say one of the key dates would be the First World War, where somehow people lost their absolute belief in God, King, and Fatherland. And today we're living in a world where there's a great uncertainty about the future of civilization. So what we've learned in the last years is the fragility of our culture and our civilization. We're thinking globally. It's no longer just my local society, my nation. We think globally. So everything that we think about time, beginnings and endings, has a global significance, which makes it qualitatively much more powerful. So, you know, there's the image, the fantasy, the world's going to end, is a very large fantasy. And one doesn't know the future. So I think it's all about the uncertainty. We know there's huge changes taking place. This has made a lot of people very uncertain. And so they kind of project onto this Mayan calendar this view that the world is going to end.
When you talk about the uncertainty of everything, yet the date itself, this given date people are coalescing around, is a very, very definite thing. It's a very particular day, right? So that kind of increases certainty, decreases uncertainty. I wonder if that's something to do with it as well.
This is not the only vision. If you look at the Christian tradition, I'm sure there are similar visions in other religions, that the idea of the end of the world is quite prevalent. They maybe not say the actual date, but they might say, several visions about the end of the world with the millennium change when we reached 2000. So, I mean, for example, there's Edgar Cayce in America, who was also a sort of something like a clairvoyant, a kind of prophet who predicted a shift in the poles, and that this would not be the end of the world, but a huge, huge change. There are many saints who have talked about that. For example, one said, you know, yes, the end of the world is going to come very soon, and make sure that you have woolen clothes on and that the color of your clothing is yellow. Otherwise, you might not be saved. So, and they're very serious people. They often have something definite, whether it's the color of your clothing, whether it's a definite time. So that gives a poignancy to the end of the world. It's like people can fix on the one day and the tension mounts. Well, you know, we've got so many seconds, so many minutes, so many hours, so many days to the end, like a rocket taking off into space.
Countdown, sort of.
Countdown, exactly.
But what from a psychological point of view, what is the gratification of that countdown, of making it so definite?
It makes it more poignant. It makes it more dramatic. And the soul, the psyche, loves drama. So to be or not to be on the 21st of December is a very powerful dramatic statement. So that gets your interest in this. You get absorbed by it. You're waiting. You're talking because it's something definite. I think it's the drama that captures us all. And I would say that the end of the world fantasies have a significance, have a prospective significance, in the sense that we take endings very seriously. They're very dramatic. Don't assume that that life as it is now will just go on, will just continue. Compensating that fantasy, we have the end of the world fantasy.
John Hill, Jungian analyst, lecturer and author, is speaking to Tidings from Hazel Kahn from Zurich, Switzerland. This is WPKN Radio.
Now, on the one hand, you and me and anybody who's listening to this interview knows very well that, depending on our age, the world will end. I'm nearly 70, So 20 years, I'm lucky. It would be quite extraordinary if I lived for 30 years. I doubt very much that. But the world for me is going to end in 10 years, in 20 years. I know that. So therefore, it sort of instills into me, and I would say many other people, to take the possibility of a completely different world starting. The world as I know it is going to end, and I have to think seriously if or when another world will start. Now, that's the very essence of the Mayan idea, that there's a cycle, there's going to be a death, and there's going to be a rebirth, and that's going to happen to every one of us. So therefore, instead of taking the end of the world to be the 21st of December, try to shift it, to see it in terms of your own ending and your own understanding of the contingency and limitation of our life here on Earth.
So we should talk about beginnings then as well.
Mm-hmm.
And those beginnings are even more unknown.
Absolutely. When we're thinking of a hereafter, of course, what do we know about that?
When you talked about the global size of the anxieties and the endings and so on, you didn't actually mention climate change in particular, but certainly, you know, that is a very powerful part of the background. And I think films, movies recently have shown the end of the world and then the beginning of whatever dystopian world replaces it. It used to be heaven and angels and stuff like that, right? Now it's much more ugly, only three people left in the world and they're fighting each other for survival, that kind of thing. So I was just wondering if you could, you know, what is it about beginnings that are frightening or, yeah, I guess that are frightening or that are unknown or I don't know, just anything if you would talk about the beginnings.
That's a very good question and probably very difficult to answer. Yes, a beginnings not necessarily will just take place after I die, but maybe as I'm still alive. It is a beautiful medieval statement that Martin Heidegger uses. Young enough to live is old enough to die. In other words, a mature life must incorporate some kind of understanding or philosophy of a life after death, and preparation that you are going to die. As for a new beginning, on the one hand, it can be already rooted in a new attitude to your actual life here on Earth while you're still alive. They've interviewed people who've had near-death experiences about meeting a tunnel and going and encountering light and so forth. And one of the conclusions that Moody made was that when these people return from such an experience, they felt they had to learn more and be more loving and kind in their relationships. Now, that's an example of where you begin a new life here on Earth. Maybe these people touch something of the hereafter, maybe touch something of what we traditionally know as heaven, or a religious saint or religious figure, and they became inspired to change their life. That's a new beginning.
But in between the ending and the new beginning, there's the transition.
Yeah.
Now, if you're having a near-death experience, it may not be a transition because one doesn't usually expect near-death experiences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I don't know if you agree, if you could talk about the fact that we are in transition, that, you know, it's almost a cliche to say that the old institutions are failing and that life as we know it appears to be in transition. Whether it's financial or political or environmental or technological, whatever, there's many, many factors that are creating a transition. So are we in transition? Are we being transformed? Are those different ideas? I don't know.
I would say yes, and I agree with you that I think that the old world where something that fixed norms, social norms, cultural norms, religious norms, how to behave correctly, how to be a good person, certainly lost a lot of its convincing power. So I couldn't get away from the feeling that we are, to a certain extent, in a battle to try to preserve the fullness of creation and the beauty of this planet, and avoid the temptation to just loot it. Life is short, so you might as well enjoy it. Go shopping, buy as much as you can. That's just not a healthy attitude. That would bring eventually more disaster than redemption.
So that's part of individualism, the sort of plundering or looting is part of the individual consciousness, maybe, as opposed to trying to save the planet, which maybe is more collective.
Well, no, there's a whole section of the population, governments who are involved in this, who feel we have a right to use the resources. We need to keep our population in their present state of all the amenities that they have. So it's not just individual. Of course, basically it goes down to individuals because we all want our car and our fridge and all that kind of stuff. Gradually, though, there is a hope of something new appearing because we're all becoming more and more aware of just can't go on living like this.
What do you think Jung would say if he sat around on this conversation with us? How would he see it?
Well, Jung, you know, he's had, if you read Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he's had many thoughts of the future. And as far as I know, I can't say exactly what he would say, but certainly he'd say, you have to become more aware of your inner self, that outer satisfaction is not enough. You have a living soul within you, and you have to take that seriously. It gives you dreams, it gives you fantasies, it gives you feelings that somehow guide you through life. Take the inner world seriously. Try to understand also what nourishes the soul. So if I may say, it's something like the Duino elegies of Rilke. And in the, I think it's the 9th elegy, Rilke talks about meeting the angel. It doesn't define exactly what that is, but it's something about change and afterlife. Or even in this life, meeting the angels. And the angel doesn't want to know that you've had an illuminous experience, great experiences that really have been fantastic and cosmic. The angel wants to know, what have you done with the earth? Have you created a pot, a rope, a poem? Have you made something that you can offer to the angel, the mystery of life? With the materials of the earth, something beautiful, something creative. I think that's our task, to indeed transform material reality, life on this earth, into something meaningful and beautiful. That's a sign of what the new should be, rather than just continuing on the old ways and plundering this beautiful planet.
But we need the fear of the old collapsing, or disintegrating, or going up in flames. We need that in order to get to this new...
Yes, I think you're right there. Indeed, I do. It's because fear makes us aware of limitations. Of course, pathological fear, we don't dare do anything. We're just paralyzed. But a reasonable fear that really makes you aware of the dangers, that is definitely necessary. So fear, you're absolutely right. Fear is the necessary to be aware of limitations, of dangers.
Yet there also seems to be this other sort of perverse thing about fear. For instance, the media, let's say, or people whipping up the fear to go back to the Mayan calendar and the Mayan date, December 21st, or whether it was Y2K and the end of the world was going to come that way, or whatever it is, the rapture. But there seems to be something perverse about making other people afraid.
Yeah, if you make people afraid, they fall into a kind of paralysis. They just wait for the end. The end will not come on the 21st of December. So they say, okay, now we can go back to the ordinary life again. So nothing happens. There's no change. So now we can just go back to everyday life, not understanding that these fantasies of ending, the ending of life, the ending of civilization, have a significance. They have a very powerful significance, a cultural, a deep psychological significance, that change is inevitable and that we're all going to meet the end of the world individually.
But you think they're amplified right now with all these external factors that we've talked about?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a collective hysteria, yes, that would be something that is just not to be welcomed. Because you just won't learn from what this means. You've got to understand these kind of things, what their psychological significance, what is the significance for the human soul. Why does the human soul get attached to these kind of fantasies? Because it somehow knows or tries to make you indirectly aware that there will be an ending. So try to make your life meaningful in terms of that ending. And don't think that life is just going to be the same forevermore.
So do you think that all around the world, or at least in some of the countries we've talked about, maybe not in Switzerland, that people are having more dreams, more sort of apocalyptic dreams, or more what you might call numinous dreams right now?
Well, no, that would be a question which I really couldn't answer. You know, somebody would want to go around and make a lot of interviews, maybe of 1,000 people and so. But in my practice, and now I've just come back from Tbilisi, Georgia, and I have done supervision, so I've heard of a lot of dreams. I find nothing, neither in my practice nor in this work I've done in Georgia, any sign that dreams have become more apocalyptic. Now, that might be just my limited experience.
Yeah, because, I mean, that means that all of these things that have pumped up this interest in the 21st of December, that it might really not be that profound. Maybe we don't have to take this particular manifestation very seriously.
Well, you know, I think it's important to take it seriously, but more symbolically seriously, as a symbol, because we don't know how many people have got caught in this. But if I said, no, don't take it seriously, maybe I'd be dismissing what they are really experiencing and believing in as something very powerful and very threatening. So I would say to these people, look, take that seriously. It doesn't mean to say the world is going to end, but somehow you are in a position where you really feel that something could happen that would change everything. Take that feeling seriously. Try to work on it. Try to understand what that means in your life.
I understand. Yeah, that's a very different way of looking at it. You know, this whole idea of not being literal and seeing the symbolic and the more profound significance of all of this. Because it definitely has presence. It definitely takes up space and, you know, weight in current consciousness, certainly, you know, in my environment.
Maybe I'll just mention that, which I mentioned also in an interview, that when I was, you know, about 17 or so, one of the first dreams that I can remember was an end of the world dream, in which I was out on this desert and it was all red and everything seemed to be on fire. There were no buildings. I was alone, nothing. Nothing else was there, mountains, desert area. And I woke up absolutely shocked, terrified. I was a bit crazy. I said to my fellow school friends, my God, the world is going to end. So I immediately believed it. I saw it. It's going to happen. And I'll never forget that dream, because I think it was something like the fantasies of myself at that age, 16, 17, where I somehow was where things are going to change. The world that I knew up to then was going to change. And it did happen, because then a lot happened in my life and I left my home country in Ireland and so forth, and lived for some time quite an ascetic life. So it did have significance.
Yeah, very, very interesting. John, thank you very much. I'm really happy to have had this conversation.
Well, thank you for the questions, and I wish you good luck with the program.
Was John Hill, Jungian analyst, lecturer, and author, speaking to Tidings from Hazel Kahn from Zurich, Switzerland via Skype. Tidings from Hazel Kahn is heard on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, streaming and archived on WPKN.org. All Tidings programs are available as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.